Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Design Patents and Smartphone Wars Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On December 6, 2016, the Supreme Court decided Samsung Electronics Co. v. Apple. In April 2011, Apple sued Samsung Electronics, alleging that Samsung smartphones infringed on Apple's trade dress, as well as various design patents for the iPhone. A jury awarded Apple nearly $1 billion in damages under Section 289 of the Patent Act, and the trial court upheld most of the award against Samsung's post-trial challenges. On appeal, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit rejected Samsung's argument that the district court erred by allowing the jury to award damages based on Samsung's profits off of its phones in their entirety, rather than just the portion of profits attributable to the smartphone components covered under the design patents. The question before the Supreme Court was whether, where a design patent is applied to only a component of a product, an award of infringer's profits should be limited to those profits attributable to the component. By a vote of 8-0, the Supreme Court reversed the judgment of the Federal Circuit and remanded the case. In an opinion by Justice Sotomayor, the court unanimously held that in the case of a multi-component product, the relevant article of manufacture for arriving at a damages award under Section 289 need not be the end product sold to the consumer, but may be only a component of that product. Whether the relevant article of manufacture in this particular case should be the entire smartphone or merely a component thereof is an issue the court left open for resolution on remand. To discuss the case, we have Trevor Copeland, a shareholder at Brinks Gilson & Leone, and Art Goldwitzer, a partner at Michael Best & Friedrich LLP. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Copeland and Mr. Goldwitzer.
This case has been challenging. It's been one that has been on the horizon for those of us involved in the design patent world for quite some time, given the unusual nature of the special design patent damages provision of 35 U.S.C. Section 289. Some of the things that go into the background of this that make it an interesting story, unlike many design patent and indeed many other patent litigations, this has caught the public eye because most people own a smartphone. Not everybody who has a smartphone necessarily owns one that is made by one of the litigants in this case, but these are culturally universal or near universal within modern American society and technology. I think the Supreme Court got this wrong in a couple of different ways, and in some ways it pains me to say that because, at least on its face, this decision purports to be a fairly limited holding, strongly rooted in the text of the statute. And as a committed textualist myself, at first reading, I found myself questioning whether I just didn't like the outcome and that I needed to check my premises and make sure that I wasn't being results-oriented and sacrificing my textualist principles. But I really think, even though it makes some verbal nods to textualism, the Supreme Court still gets this wrong because the short version is I think the Federal Circuit got it right by the way that it treated the definition of the article of manufacture. Some underpinning features and logic that I think goes in support of this is, one, you don't even get to damages for design patents until infringement has been determined under a very narrow, long-standing infringement test that has been tweaked and touched on a number of times over the past century plus since the Supreme Court crafted it in the Gorham v. White case. But essentially it is, if in the eye of an ordinary observer, giving such attention as an ordinary observer or purchaser usually gives, two designs are the same so that the resemblance of the accused infringing product is such to that it deceives an observer, inducing him to purchase it, supposing it to be the patented design. That's a very narrow infringement test, particularly given the narrow scope of design patents, because a design patent only covers what is shown in the images. So much of the somewhat speculative ideas that were presented even by Samsung in its briefs, alleging that someone might be able to get damages for an entire vehicle because it had an infringing design for a cup holder in it, would just, I think, are unconvincing and unavailing, because an ordinary observer is kind of your ordinary man or woman on the street. Courts and juries take that idea seriously. Now, in the present case, you have two smartphone companies. Apple came up with what has now been recognized as an iconic design, where they didn't invent much in the way in terms of new functionality. What they did is they created an appearance of the device itself and of the GUI, the graphic user interface, both of which were covered by a number of design patents, three of which a jury found to be infringed. So the article of manufacture was clearly illustrated in the three design patents in suit here. Now, in the course of a podcast or teleforum, we don't have the visual aids to put these up and compare them, but it's very clear that the jury did its job. That part of the verdict was upheld, and what the argument here came down to was the damages part. The United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit identified the entire smartphone as the only permissible article of manufacture, according to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court held that that is not consistent with the way that the term article of manufacture is used in 289 and also in 171, which is what defines design patents. I really think it is. If one looks at the Federal Circuit decision, the smallest saleable unit, to borrow, although not an entirely consistent way, terms that the Federal Circuit has applied for reasonable royalties, the smallest saleable unit was a smartphone. That's going to be what a consumer looks at and compares when he or she is making a purchasing decision. And it was quite clear, at least to the jury, that Samsung derived its design from what Apple had done. The second piece of this, I think, is that proceeds from it is in its decision, the Supreme Court did not actually outline a clear definition or test for what an article of manufacture is. Instead, it punted back to the Federal Circuit saying, well, you kind of made a test, but you got it wrong, so go make a different test. And I think any of us who have been observing the Federal Circuit, particularly for the last 6 to 10 years, where the Supreme Court has reinvigorated its attention to patent law and has reversed the Federal Circuit numerous times, is every time the Federal Circuit has come up with a test, even if it's a test that has existed for much of its 30-plus year history now, the Supreme Court has often said those tests are too rigid, they're too specialized to patent law. Patent law is just like any other law, and you have to make it fit within the bigger and broader picture, and that's what the Supreme Court is doing, or at least thinks it's doing with many patent law decisions. I think that poses a challenge to the Federal Circuit, and even though this shouldn't go into the judicial decision-making, and it may be time for Congress to step up and provide some clarity to the extent we could hope they would do so and get it right, which I'm somewhat skeptical of, is that the Federal Circuit, in trying to craft a test, I think any test as a policy matter would end up being very fact-specific. Many small companies, because of the lower cost of design patents, protect their designs rather than having to get into the technological details associated with innards and very much involved with the practice of industrial design. So if one has to engage experts to determine whether or not a certain viewpoint of a consumer, how long the is taken into account, how long the eye lingers on certain design features or other things along that line, where you end up a battle of the experts, you've essentially gutted the enforceability in any practical matter, in any practical manner of design patent law.
I, like Trevor, I think start by looking at the text. That's all been drummed into our head over the past several decades. But I think the Supreme Court got it right. I think the Supreme Court's decision is not surprising. It is the theme is that the court has been overturning Federal Circuit decisions where it finds that the appellate court has strayed from consistent legal principles. You can go back to the eBay case where the Supreme Court said that the Federal Circuit wasn't handling injunctions in the manner we handle them in the rest of our legal system and the rest of our jurisprudence. So here, the Supreme Court's theme, again, was let's be consistent. And it started, it doesn't matter if it's a well-established patent practice, if there hasn't been any Supreme Court case law on this in decades or even 100 years. Let's start with the text. And the section at issue here, Section 289 of the Patent Act, provides that a person who manufactures or sells any article of manufacture to which a design or colorable imitation has been applied, et cetera, et cetera. The key being article of manufacture. Well, what is that? And to be consistent, the Supreme Court's saying, well, let's look around. Let's see what we have, and we don't have to go any further than the rest of the Patent Act itself. In fact, we can start with Section 171 of the Patent Act, which is the statute that provides for the existence of design patents in the first place. That same section says that whoever invents a new original and ornamental design for an article of manufacture may obtain a patent. Okay, but so they should be the same, right? Except we know that when you obtain a design patent, it isn't necessarily on an entire saleable product. It can be on a portion of it. People who draft design patents know that when you write the claims are pictures, essentially, and those pictures can have dotted lines. And the dotted lines are the areas of the design that you're not claiming, and they can be anything. I mean, there's a classic example where the design is sort of the silver smithing on the handle of a fork or of a food utensil, I should say. And the other end, whether it's a fork, knife, or spoon, is shown in dotted lines because you can apply this design to any of the three. So the design, the patent covers a piece of the product. Likewise, in recent years, the courts have made very clear that design patents can't extend to things that are primarily functional. So in a design patent trial, the parties may argue over the functionality of the claim design, and the trial court should decide which aspects of the claim design are properly covered and which are primarily functional and not within the scope of the claim, and that's done in claim construction. So again, illustrating that the design, that the article of manufacture that's patented is not the whole thing, or doesn't have to. It can be, but it doesn't have to be. So the Supreme Court, I think, logically said, well, if an article of manufacture under 171 can be less than the whole, it can be less than the whole for calculating damages using the same language under Section 289. We'll go to another example. Section 101 of the Patent Act, as we know, covers what's patentable in the utility world, and among other things, it talks about improvements thereof. So we know that under Section 101, we can get patents on pieces of a product. You know, the bicycles may be around for a long time, but if my invention is new shock absorbers for my latest and greatest mountain bike, I can obtain patent protection on that improvement, and that's not necessarily the whole product. I'll go into a third example, which the court didn't touch, but I think it's consistent with the theme of being consistent, and that is the other damages statute that most people are more familiar with. That's Section 284, where in a utility patent case or a design patent case, it applies in both places, you can obtain damages no less than a reasonable royalty. And the courts in recent years have made clear that that reasonable royalty is calculated based on the smallest saleable unit. So there's a well-known case where damages by the jury, I believe, were originally calculated based on sales of the entire Microsoft Outlook program, or maybe it was the entire Office suite, I forget. When the patent scope was limited to a feature within the program. And the court ultimately held that you have to focus on that smallest saleable unit. Now, Trevor argued that people buy the entire phone, but people also buy Outlook. They don't buy this one little feature. So interpreting the patent, the design patent statute as applying to the aspect of the product, maybe the whole thing, maybe not, that is truly covered by the patent is consistent with how we handle royalty calculations in other patent cases. This is essentially a nexus. You could argue this is a nexus or a bit of a causation requirement. And if so, that's sticking with the theme, consistent with how we handle damages in other areas of tort law and patent infringement, essentially a statutory tort. So if we say that if you trespass on my property, if you vandalize my property, my damages to a certain extent are the harm that was proximately caused by your behavior. It seems consistent to say that the damages for patent infringement should have a causal relationship to the behavior. And again, on the utility patent side, I think they do, right? You can try to show lost profits, but you get no less than a reasonable royalty. But the reasonable royalty is tied to the smallest saleable unit. So we have this alternative damages statute for design patents. Why not? I think the court's being consistent in saying we should do the same thing here. If we can get what is essentially disgorgement of the infringer's profits, they should be the profits that arise from the infringement. So we should tie the patent and what it covers to the portion of the product that matches. I share I think Trevor's respect for patent rights as a whole. I think we all come at this from the perspective of this is a piece of property, just like the land that my house is built on, and we don't whittle away those rights lightly. On the other hand, we, with all pieces of property, we do craft rules, right? We have rules of procedure for all lawsuits. We have common legal principles that, at a certain level, aren't. Taking anyone's property rights away, they are setting the ground rules for litigating a dispute. And here, the Supreme Court is not attacking patent rights, in my opinion. It is simply saying that, consistent with the rest of our legal principles, this is how we're going to calculate damages. I'll conclude by pointing out that, in my opinion, this is good policy as well. There's plenty of popular press about the amount of patent litigation that we deal with today. Non-practicing entities are, I don't think, inherently evil or anything like that. But there are patents that are questionable patents that maybe should not have been issued in the first place, and the cost of litigating that is high, and therefore some plaintiffs can take advantage of that to force settlement. Well, that problem could be exacerbated in the design patent world without a decision like this, because design patents are extremely easy to obtain. As compared to a utility patent, design patents often cost less than $5,000 all in to get from application and the drawings all the way to allowance. That can take less than 18 months. In fact, it almost always does. And there's really very little scrutiny in the patent office of claim designs. So if we think that there are some questionable utility patents out there that are being exploited by some bad actors, there is even greater potential for that in the design patent world. And if the damages are the entire value of the product without regard to the scope of the invention, there will be a great deal of incentive to do so.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.fedsoc.org/multimedia.